Thank you so much. Hi, I'm Olivia, compulsive overeater, 100-pounder. Grateful to be here tonight. Just to qualify at first, I've definitely my entire life I've been a compulsive overeater. I know we are able to mention specific foods this meeting, so I'll mention this because I always do. I was literally when I was born. The doctor that delivered me was eating a grape Tootsie Pop as she delivered me. And so I think I was pretty much locked in from there. But definitely, right, like there are memories of being really young and always seeking food and always asking for food. It was something that I found really young, brought that soothing feeling to me. And I grew up in a home with a lot of dysfunction. I grew up in a home with, emotional and verbal abuse and a lot of manipulation and a lot of not talking about any of that. And I think that was really hard for me as a little kid to try and figure out what we were doing if not talking about any of that. And also they were just emotions and feelings that I just couldn't really process. I wasn't really just cut out to process. And you know, I think the food was a good tool in that. I think I found the food really young because of that. And I think that to be honest, looking back, that was pretty smart of that young kid to be able to figure out that that would be something that would help. And that, right, like I think that my higher power gave me the food at that young age because I think my higher power only gives me what I can handle. And at that time, there were things happening that I couldn't handle. And because of that, I was given a tool to not feel those things. But as I got older and continued to use that, that tool started making my life really, really small. And that food start that well that food but that tool of the food started limiting the life that my higher power actually wanted me to be living. And I continued eating. Really, my weight for me, my weight just climbed up. There was not a lot of up and down. There were like random diets certainly throughout things, but I mean, I was only losing like 10 pounds on like a 250-pound body. Like the, it was not a lot of up and down. It was pretty much just up. And a lot of people, out of a lot of fear, family and doctors and friends were telling me, you know, like, it's really hard to be this way in this world. And you should really fix this now. And everyone's telling me to fix this physical thing. But it wasn't even connecting really quite in my brain that this physical thing and this tool that was keeping me, like, what I felt sane and safe, that those were connected. And the small moments where I did understand them to be connected, right? When a pediatrician would be like, you shouldn't eat these foods, I was like, but you don't understand, I won't survive if I don't. Like I hear what you're saying, but you but I need you to have dinner at, with my family for one night, and then we'll find out if I'm able to eat one fistful of protein or not. Like it just didn't feel possible. And it felt like death. But then there were a lot of lies in my head, the disease of like, okay, well, once I'm in college, this will be easier. And then, okay, well, now it's COVID, fine. Okay, I'm home. So then once COVID's over, once I graduate college, once I'm working, once I'm on my own, all these like once I, everything will be easier and fine. But it got to the point where like, you know, I was powerless to the food. The food was controlling me. It didn't matter what the context was. I was ordering food at 2 a.m. that I didn't even want to eat, but I was just going as fast as I could on Apple Pay on my phone just so that it'd be done before I could realize and make a decision because I was so scared with it. It just it felt it was out it was against my like willpower at that point. And I kept telling the people that were concerned, right? My brother said to me when I was 23, we were at my grandmother's funeral, and that night he said that he was scared about my weight. He said, "Don't make us bury you next." And he doesn't remember saying that because he's not somebody that would just go around saying that. I think that was God speaking through him because it wasn't to be mean, right? Like, that's a tough way to say it, but I don't know how else I could have heard it. And over the next year, you know, I really tried to self-will that one. I was like, okay, I'm scaring my brother. That's not fair. He's not my parent. It's fine if I scare my parent. They're always going to be scared no matter what, but I can't scare my brother. It's not nice. It's not okay. And so over the next year, I tried every diet. I tried different medications. I worked with a nutritionist. I did all these things, but it was all just this like self-will, and it was just like the axle grinding on the ground. And it took until I was like 24 years old. I was 24 years old and 375 pounds. And I had to cancel a flight to go see my best friend across the country because I couldn't sit on a plane for 6 hours. And because I knew that I couldn't walk around San Francisco. And this friend, who, first of all, my best friend since I was 3 years old, she had also had like emergency brain surgery a couple years before and like had all these things going on. And it just made me realize like, this is just, I'm canceling a trip for fun, but like, I can't get to her. I can't get to her. And also, my life is really, really small. And I called my mom at that point, who had been begging to come and live in New York with me and cook for me. Because right, this is a family disease of control, and that was out of love. But you know, it's a family disease of control. She just, right, in her head, if she could just come to New York and just cook for me and control everything that I was eating, then that would be fine. And I called her and I said, you know, I don't want you to come to New York and cook for me, but I need help. And she and I kind of found a way at similar times, both in our kind of research. And I, of course, had everything in the every story in the book of why it wasn't going to work for me and why I should try and find something else. And I, you know, kept trying to go around it. And I would say the first time that I went to an OA meeting, it wasn't some like lightning strike, which I was waiting for my entire life. It was honestly that I had had like what's actually a normal conversation with my boss, where I sort of expressed like, hey, I'm feeling overwhelmed right now. I need a little bit less. And he said, okay, no worries. I'm glad you told me. That is how well the conversation went. It went totally fine. To me, that was terrifying because it was setting the boundaries as a people pleaser. And I was like, okay, well, I should order food. Like, I deserve to do that. Like, I just want to eat. I don't want to like feel any of this anymore. And I just had like this quiet, right, this small, still voice in the back of my head being like, I just don't want to do that anymore. Like, what if I just didn't do that tonight? And I got on an OA meeting. And I got a sponsor and I found a plan of eating and an abstinence. And it was with my nutritionist. The food plan of it was my nutritionist, but I didn't have the willingness to do it and to surrender to doing it without program. And it's funny, sometimes when I see her, and we're all people, but sometimes when I see her, she'll be like, you're so good. You do everything I say. And I'll be like, remember the years that I didn't? Like, I'm like, this isn't me. Like, this isn't me. And thank you for the guidance. And right, and I continue, I try and spread the message. It's this program. And before the meeting, I was meditating and praying a bit and asking kind of God what God would have me share on this meeting. And the imagery that was coming up for me was of like an antelope. And when I was looking into that more, because I don't always know what this stuff means, I was looking into like the instincts of an antelope. And the instincts of an antelope is fight or flight. Like, an antelope is driven by action, but a lot of that is driven by like fear. And I think that is how I was living my entire life, was driven by fear towards like actions that were harming me. And the truth is, like, action has been a good thing in my recovery. Action has been important in my recovery. And I recognize the miracle that recovery has brought to me as far as willingness to take action, even to sit down at that first meeting. But whereas the antelope is driven by this like fear and fight or flight, which I lived my entire life in, this fear and fight or flight, like, now with recovery, like, I get to take action, but based on a power greater than myself and based on things that are just bigger than me in this program. And for me, I mean, that came through the steps, and it came through the steps not perfectly and not smoothly, and had to run a couple of those back a couple of times as I tried to test out a few more character defects a couple of times along the way, and that's okay. But it came through the steps. It came through looking in step four at all of the things. Well, nope, it came, I mean, step one I was pretty clear on, but it came through looking at steps two and three and putting down the ego that, right, I had grown up in a home where it was very privileged to the point of, you know, if you're messing up, why are you messing up? You have everything you need. So I kind of thought that maybe God was the same, that maybe God was thinking like, well, I gave you everything you need, kid. Like, if you mess up, like, that's on you. And I thought that's what God was. And it was really scary to approach a God that cared about me and that had more capacity than I did, right? It was ego. It was like, well, God couldn't possibly care about me because I could only handle one thing at a time. So how is God handling all of the world and me? but God's bigger than me. So I don't know why I was so stuck on my capacity for what God could do. And then being forced to confront like this guilt that I had of how poorly I treated myself. But that was also just still, that was still me just trying to keep myself from recovering, because if I could just keep myself being guilted, then I wouldn't have to take the action. And to turn that over in steps two and three, and even four to some degree, right? That was an action of taking the step forward to be like, okay, so I've done these things, but then what is next? Instead of sitting and just hating myself for doing these things to myself. And again, like I was only ready once I was ready. But in steps four, like looking at those things that put me in fight or flight. In steps five, like there were things that I told my sponsor in step five that I've never told anyone in the world. Things that I thought were, I mean, that I swore to take to the grave. But I was like digging my grave with them every single day by living behind them and living in fear of them. And like once I said them, like it wasn't such a big deal. It wasn't such a big deal because like it turned out I was a person, but that was really hard for me to find out. And step six and seven, like those are the ones I ran back a couple times because I still was in some fight or flight. I was still like, well, I need some of these character defects. I need these character defects. They've kept me protected. They've kept me guarded. And I was really scared to put them down. I had some trust in God, but I was like, all right, God, why don't you and I delegate? I'll take some of these things and you take some of these things. And God delegated. God was like, all right, you want to run this back one more time, see what happens with this defect? Go for it, kid. And a close fellow of mine has said to me, you know, God's on the other side of the trap door too. And that's what happened there, was I used that defect one more time, a couple of those defects one more time, but God was on the other side of that trap door and got me back on course. But it certainly proved to me that those defects were not there to protect me anymore, that those defects were there to hold me back. And that my disease, right? My disease was in fight or flight at that point. My disease was in fight or flight, worried that I was gonna walk away from it. And it was doing all it could. And that's fair too. Like that disease is a part of my like inner child. Like there's so much fear. It thought it was protecting me for a long time. Like I try and meet my disease with some level of compassion. It's not this enemy. It's this thing that thought it was protecting me for a really long time. But now I get to say to it, like, thank you for that. But like I have other things that I need to try now. Like you can rest. This like scared part of me that pushes me towards the food, like it's okay. You can relax now. And I don't have to meet it with hate. And I think like action has played such a pivotal role in my recovery because I don't know that I can sit here and tell you that at every moment I've had faith. Like faith is not, I don't think that I've ridden this recovery out on faith because I think there have been a lot of moments where I've had to act without it. But I'm like grateful that God has given me the willingness to act anyway because I knew that going back, there was just, I knew how that was going to go. Like, if I went back to an old pattern, to an old way, like, I try and lead with a lot of curiosity in my life. I'm in theater. There's a lot of play in my life, which I'm grateful for. I try to lead with like playfulness and curiosity and all of that. And there was no curiosity. If I go back, I know exactly what that looks like. It looks like 375 pounds canceling a flight to see my best friend. And that just left me with no option but to move forward instead. And there was definitely hard nights of early recovery, but the kind of like visualization that comes to my mind with that is like I remember feeling like I felt like I was climbing up from the depths of the earth, like climbing up out of this ladder on this ladder from the depths of the earth. And every day was like a different rung on the ladder. And some days were hotter than others, and some days were harder to hold on. And I knew like if I fell, first of all, I knew I couldn't fall one rung. If I was going to fall, I was going to fall all the way down. And that's okay because God was going to be there and I could get back on the ladder and I could climb back up. It's not that the ladder was going to disappear. But I remember like day 32 was really hard. And I remember being like, okay, well, if I fall back down to the bottom, I'm just going to get back up to day 32 again. So, like, I don't want to do day 32 again because, like, man, this sucks. Like, this is hard. So maybe I'll just try and get to the next one and take whatever action I need to take. And I remember that night, like, I sat at my computer. And I wrote for like 3 hours and I was fighting with my disease and writing. Like I went back and read it a few days later and it was just me fighting with this other part of my brain that just wanted my life to stay small because it thought that that meant it was safe. But That's because it was still my brain trying to figure out what I could handle. Like my brain is right. I cannot handle how big like my life has gotten in recovery. That is true. But like the good thing is that I don't have to because I can turn it over. I can turn it over to a higher power. I can turn it over to the tools. I can turn it over to the steps, to fellows. Right? Like I got like a like somewhat difficult, not even so much, but difficult news tonight. And I just called a fellow right away. And I did a 10th. Versus like drowning in it because I wanted to be able to come onto this meeting, like be of any sort of service. And I was like, if I just suppress this and I run from it, then I'm just hurting everyone. And that's not interesting. I'm not curious about what happens there. And I think like other places of action, right, of action instead of faith, maybe like I'm somebody that it's hard for me to always believe that things are going to be okay. And it's really hard for me, I will say, in the moments of difficult emotions in this program, I have had a hard time sometimes when the response is like, remember, like you're okay and everything's gonna be okay. I think that there's a need to feel the emotions because I think that I spent my entire life right as that antelope running from those emotions. And I don't think there's anything wrong with sitting and feeling it and being upset and being angry. And right, there's a difference in being angry and like, falling totally into a pit of resentment that keeps me in selfishness. But like, this program has taught me how to feel my emotions and it has challenged me to advocate for my emotions, even within the program. And my sponsor will say to me, you know, like, this program is not your higher power. Your higher power is your higher power. And that has helped me to find the parts of this program that I need in the moments that I need. And I need all of this program, but there are just different moments where the right things stand out. Where writing stands out, or outreach stands out, or a 10th stands out, or just like feeling it stands out, and that's okay too. And feeling angry. I spent my entire life refusing to feel angry. At 16 years old, I remember my voice teacher, like my singing teacher, being like, really like try and dig into your anger here in this song. Like, think about the time you were really angry. And I remember at 16 going, I don't get angry. It's a waste of time. Okay, what 16-year-old doesn't get angry? Like, that's not true. I just was terrified of being angry, so I never let myself feel it. So when I feel those emotions now, like I'm just so grateful. Action for me looks like sending my sponsor my food every night before I go to sleep for the next day. And self-amends for me looks like following that food the next day and eating that food that I said I was going to eat. Action looks like texting my friends and saying, you know, I want to go to Six Flags. I told you guys I didn't like roller coasters. That wasn't true. I haven't been able to fit on roller coasters and I was embarrassed of that. But that's not true. I do like roller coasters. I was wondering if we could go to Six Flags and now we're going to Six Flags next week. And like that's action. I signed up last night for a women's rec league basketball game on July 23rd that I've been terrified to sign up for because I was like, what if I'm not good at basketball anymore? Because I haven't played since 8th grade. And I signed up, and I don't know if I'm going to go, to be honest. I don't know what's going to happen, but I took the action of signing up, and it's taken me a month to do that. And that's a self-amends to myself because I miss it. I miss basketball. I miss playing in that way, too. And action just looks like getting on the meeting, even if I don't want to get on the meeting, or doing the 10th. It certainly looks like doing the 10th, and I don't want to do the 10th. And it's acting without faith sometimes, too, and acting as if because I already know what happens if I don't. And I think like that's where the antelope comes in for me is like, because a lot of what was coming up was like acting on intuition. And that intuition is there now from a higher power because the food's not in the middle of it. And, you know, I'll end just with a couple of pictures that I can show. And I have lost 100, like 150 pounds this program. My life has opened up because of it. But you know, I'll say to be honest, more than that, like I think I like look freer. Like I don't point out this picture to be like, look how unhappy and miserable I was. Like that's not really what I'm interested in pointing out, but it's more like I think there's a lot more freedom over here and ability to take that action. I took the action of moving myself from Manhattan to Brooklyn because I was no longer afraid that I was supposed to live in Manhattan because it was more impressive to I don't know who, but Brooklyn brought me peace and it brought me closer to my higher power. So I moved. And when I don't want to take the action, the last picture in here, this is why I take those actions. because I can't go back and change a bunch of stuff that I'm resentful at in my childhood that I tried to let go of in 4 and 5, that some days is gone and some days isn't. And I'll end on this. I know the time's running. I know that I can't change those things, but I get to show up for this kid now. And like, that's the actions that I can take. And that's a blessing beyond any blessing that any of these other pictures can show. So thank you all for letting me share, and I will pass.
Thank you so much, Olivia. Let's give our speaker, Olivia, a big round of applause for a wonderful share. Now is the time to ask our speaker questions. As we are still recording, we ask that you put your questions in the chat and I will read them aloud. You're welcome to message them to me directly or to the group. We ask that you do not come off mute to ask your question or to thank the speaker verbally in this section, as we don't have permission to record other attendees. We will allow up to 15 minutes for questions for our speaker, after which time we will have sharing until 15 minutes after the hour and then in our parking lot. So our first question is, it's actually a two-part question. How do you know when you are not spiritually fit? How do you know when you are spiritually fit?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's, the first thing that came to my mind was God is not in a rush like I'm in a rush. Like, God's got nowhere to be. God's got the timing under control. God's not worried about the timeline. So when I'm running as fast as I can, like, that's when I know that I'm running on self-will and not in a spiritually fit condition versus. When I, and sometimes it's uncomfortable. Sometimes it's literally uncomfortable. I will feel like I'm sitting there with, like, everything's okay. There's nothing to do. I want something to do. I want something to fix. Somebody give me something to fix. And in some ways, though, I'm like, that's actually because I'm not orchestrating anything right now. And I'm just like kind of basking in what God has put in front of me, which can be really scary to do. So it's like there's two things. It's like, oh, how beautiful, and some fear too, because I think like that's just not what, right? If I'm used to living in fight or flight, it can be hard to adjust to that. But like that's the beauty of program, is again that like God's on the other side of the trap door, and that this program is on the other side of the trap door, and we get to make those mistakes. Not even mistakes, but we get to have moments of self-will and still recover from them as long as we can be honest about them. So I think that's honestly what comes to my mind as far as being spiritually fit and spiritually unfit, is like God is not in a rush. So when I find myself in the world's biggest rush, I know that it's because I need to slow down. Yeah.
Thank you. What has surprised you most in your recovery?
I think what surprised me most in my recovery is the role that asking for help has played in it. Because I think that I came in with such this mentality of that I needed to figure out how to do everything myself, even program. I was like, I gotta figure out how to do this myself. I gotta do it the best. I gotta do it the fastest. I gotta win. Not against any of you, but like just win in general. I don't know against who, but and I think what has surprised me is that it doesn't take as much as I assume it does from people to ask for help. That it's okay to do that, and that God has actually put the people in my life that I should be asking for help. He's put them there for a reason. And I'm surprised every time I'm willing to ask for help. But it's opened up my life so much. Like I'm a performer, and like, I mean, this is just a bizarre thing to say, but that like this month I have a sold out off-Broadway run, and that's because of my friend that offered, that said, I want to produce your show. I mean, it's because of, it's because of God, it's because of all these things, but it's because of my friend said, I want to produce a show. And I said to her, I don't know what that means. And she said, I don't know what that means either. And I said, okay, great, let's do it. Because she was just said, I don't know, I just want to help. I just want to help. I believe in the show. And like she's the reason so much of like this has happened, and like I had to get out of the way, and every day it tests me to get out of the way, So that has surprised me is how much I've had to get out of the way, but also the willingness. I think that's been one of the bigger miracles. And also, I think rediscovering an inner child in play. I think I always identified as someone who really lived in a lot of like play and inner child feelings, but I don't think I realized how small I had made my life in my disease, where like Six Flags or like playing basketball or literally being able to sit down in an improv scene to act like a little kid and know that I can get back up again. Like I stopped sitting in improv scenes because I was scared that I wouldn't be able to get back up without help. Right? It was in every single part of my life. And now like it's really cool to experience those miracles. Like literally I'll have an improv show and like my scene partner will go out and like sit down on the stage, and I have a moment where I'm like, I can do that. And like, it is not lost on me, and I'm grateful it's not. So I think like those miracles, I was going to say they're smaller miracles, but they're not. But those miracles surprise me every time because I'm like, God just shows up in so many places that it's pretty cool. So yeah.
Thank you. Tell us about that little girl. How do you relate to her differently than before?
Yeah, it's interesting. I felt really guilty looking at that little girl for a long time. I felt like even though there was no way I possibly could have, I should have been able to help her or save her or do something. So I had a really hard time looking back at that kid, and it's still hard for me sometimes. It's still hard for me to show those pictures sometimes. It's still hard for me to connect. Sometimes I have a really hard time with kids, period, actually, which I don't, which I know is related. But that's the thing is that it's just like an everyday relationship of asking like, oh, like what do you need today? And that I don't, it's been learning that neither of us have to fix the other one. And like giving her that permission too, because that kid, like she grew up needing to fix it, feeling like she needed to fix everything for people. And now I get to tell her that she doesn't need to do that, that she's okay and that she's enough. And I tell her that when I'm uncomfortable telling her that, like even out loud, of like, you're enough. And like, it like gets caught in my throat. It feels uncomfortable, but I'm like, but that's that action of like, well, what if I just did it anyway? And I think the biggest way that I like relate to that little girl now is I just try and take her with me. I just try and like take her with me wherever I go. I'm not wearing it right now for some reason. I think because I showered, but I have a bracelet that like represents that inner child. And that bracelet came from asking the inner child, like, what do you need? And the answer that came back was a really strong intuition to like make this bracelet where it's like all white beads and one pink bead and just wear that everywhere to just like bring her on this life that I get to live. And like I'm so excited to like wear that bracelet off Broadway. Like that's so cool, right? And like I can't change the past of things, and that's okay. But I get to like bring her with me now. And that's a lot of what the show's about. So I mean she's everywhere. The show that I'm doing, I wrote it, and that's a lot of what it's about, even though it's uncomfortable at the end for me to go there. But it's about that call to take care of your inner child because we can't fix the world, but we can look, we can try and help. Like what's in us. So I guess that, I don't know if that answers that question, but that's what comes to mind.
What character defects has God removed from you?
I think trying to, I'm thinking back on the ones that I like took for another spin. In moments, in a lot of moments, God removes scarcity, the scarcity mindset for me, and that is probably one of the biggest miracles. This mindset that I have to take what is not right for me, or not, yeah, what is not right for me because there won't be anything else. That I should take poor treatment from people, that I should settle for things that don't make me happy, that I should hurt myself in one way or another because there's not going to be enough of life. And so I should just take that. And, or that I shouldn't take action because what if something goes wrong? And that I'm able to take the action and not be in scarcity, but to be in like some sort of trust and abundance. And I do that. I did that with people too. I would hold on to people that I didn't need to be holding on to, and that was not helpful to me or to them. Even if I wasn't like hurting them, it was dishonest. And that wasn't helping anybody grow, including me. So I think like scarcity got is removed. Perfectionism got is removed. It's interesting because I've done improv for 19 years, and yet like that's the only place that I'm able to like let perfectionism go in some ways, but like and just be like, well, whatever happens, happens. But like working on the show and like preparing in so many different big ways, like I've just been able to set aside like perfectionism in a moment to trust that God will put the right tools in front of me when I need them. And I don't always know for sure that that's going to happen, but again, I think that's where like that action piece comes in for me of knowing that I have to just find out because I've seen what happens if I just try and force my way and it makes my life smaller. Because like even this my friend that I work with as my producer or my director or so many different people, like they have ideas I could never have. So it's like so much more interesting to be able to open up there than to force whatever my idea is. So yeah, perfectionism, scarcity. And in some ways, all of that relates to fear, but I'm not going to claim to have had fear lifted. But yeah, those are the, what come to mind.
How has your life getting bigger evolved for you, and was it a spiritual awakening?
Yeah, I think it was definitely a spiritual awakening because, again, like, I mean, my friends even will say to me, like, a friend said to me, like, about a year into program. And I always mess up a little bit how she said it, but she said to me that she admired the way that in the last year I had been able to identify what mattered to me and act within those values instead of acting within what everyone else wanted me to do. And I was like, dang, that's pretty good if that's true. And I think like that's a spiritual awakening is I think of it says in the big book of like we no longer apologize for following our higher power. That might not be an exact the exact quote, but like we no longer apologize for that. And that feels really vulnerable at times to like, especially to be honest, to be, I don't know, to be like 26 in New York City. I'm not in like the art scene. Not everyone's like, what does God say? And that's okay. I don't need that to be the case, but like there's a truth in that. And I'm not saying that's easier for the next person or the next person, but like I want to. A lot of my friends are like, I don't know, there could be God. My friends see me as like the most religious person they've ever met in some ways, and like the most spiritual person they've ever met in some ways. And so sometimes it can feel really vulnerable when that actually, when push comes to shove, and I actually say I'm going to go pray about it, and then I can feel the slight pullback of like, oh, you really mean it. But this spiritual, and there's never pushback for real, but there's always this like unfamiliarity. But to not apologize for it. And that's been, I think, the spiritual awakening that has made my life bigger because then it has led me to make decisions based on like my truth and like who I like what I value rather than like what I fear. Nobody was ever really pressuring me to make decisions one way or another. I'm not, it's not blaming anyone else for any of it. It's more like I can conjure up all the expectations I think people have of me and then act within that because I fear disappointing them. But by not apologizing anymore for following my higher power, like I'm suddenly willing to disappoint people. And what I found is that it's brought me to the right people. And that it's okay to disappoint people too. Worst case, I'm a little disappointing. That's okay. That's what my mom said to me before a work retreat. She said, worst case, you're a little disappointing. My life has gotten so much bigger. I'm in my career, I'm doing what I actually care about instead of what was just like running me dry. And in my like other job that I work that like actually gives me money and health insurance, I feel like I'm able to make an impact. And I feel like I'm able to help people and not hurt people. I work with teenagers, and that's a vulnerable age group to work with. And like I'm so grateful I have program because I'm so grateful that I'm able to be of service to them and not try and control. And just like I'm so grateful that I am out of the way with those kids because that is a important thing to be. My life has gotten bigger as far as my friendships getting deeper. Even today when I told my friends something, I was like, I'm just like embarrassed about this. They were like, we're literally just glad you're telling us. Like, we don't even really have as many like thoughts and judgments as you think we do. Like, we're just actually grateful you're sharing. And like that shocked me. Because I was like, they're gonna think I'm an idiot, they're gonna think this, they're gonna think that. They actually just thought I was their friend. And one of them said, I'm grateful to show up for you as a friend today. And like, what a thing. Like, what a thing to say and be able to accept. So yeah, I would say those are many of the ways my life has gotten bigger.
How has your abstinence evolved, and what is your relationship to food today? That'll be our last question, I believe.
Yeah, thank you. My abstinence, I kind of like accidentally was in a hospitalization period at the beginning of program, meaning like was very like strict. That was because it was over the winter holidays and I'm a dog sitter, so I had six dogs in my apartment and I just didn't leave. So that was a weird thing at the beginning, but it definitely helped. That was definitely God's doing. Which I know I could have binged that whole time too, but something about that structure kept me there. My abstinence very early was three meals a day with nothing in between except for like I can have like a protein drink or like a smoothie or like something like liquid for me like in between, but like filling. And that hasn't changed. That's been a really safe guardrail for me to have. But I've had to allow myself to expand a bit as far as like it's okay for me to like food. Like as my abstinence has grown, there is a very clear difference to me when I have a food and I think, oh, that was good. And when I have a food and there is this thing that goes off in my brain, and I use the TNT emoji when I text my sponsor if it happens, where like suddenly I am like a raccoon. Like I don't even know. That is what comes to my mind. I'm like obsessive over it. I'm like, my brain can't concentrate. I'm foggy. I'm this and that. I can't do anything but think about it. And like that's just so not worth my sanity. And I'll finish this up. I know the time. And so my abstinence, but I've had to work with that push and pull of like making sure I'm not working an abstinence that is harder than mine and that I'm not overly restricting. And also making sure that I'm not like using that to find my little excuses. But for me, it's asking God and asking God and bringing God into those meals and knowing that like God is happy for me to enjoy food, but that God is happy for food to be something that fuels my life, even if in a positive way too. I don't just mean down to like the bare minimum of fuel, but that my life has gotten so much bigger than food. And when that happens, I'm like, whoa, that was really good. I'm like, you know what's cooler than that? Even though the TNT thing is going off in my mind, the fact that I'm going to a baseball game tomorrow where I get to bring my dog and I get to sit in the seat comfortably. Like that's bigger and that's more interesting. I'm way more curious about that than having another bite of the thing that set off the thing in my brain. So that's my relationship with the food is I get it. Sometimes I taste it and I'm like, all right, I see you. I get it. Yeah, that's pretty good. But life's better, and that's a really cool thing. So yeah, I will pass.